So, welcome to today's lecture in programming languages. Last time we finished the chapter about the memory models and had an example where a memory model definition is quite crucial and what you can do in order to rectify the chaos that the absence of certain guarantees on your memory model is achieving. Yes, please. What is with the microphone?
I don't think it's working.
Looks like it. usually it's this one and not this one that's responsible, and this should just work.
Could you be referring to the last computer system?
Oh, can't you hear me? Oh, okay, so.
I'm sorry, technically, it was just referring to the recording. So, have a look. Can you hear me now better? This is the loudest that I can do. Let's have a look at it. What this thing says. No. How about now? Maybe even better than that. Okay. So,
last time we finished with this memory model topic, and now we go on to a little bit higher level entities in concurrent programming. So, let's dive right in. As kind of a motivation, what is the thing that comes next after the facilities that we had for establishing distributed protocols? Well, what usually also pops up as a requirement on your algorithm is that when you write concurrent software, that a particular thread of your software needs to update not only just one singular cell in memory, but usually multiple memory locations that need to be modified exclusively by that particular thread, at least for a certain time. Why is that? Well, you might want to guarantee that there's a certain consistency properties for these memory locations in play all the time. And as soon as you start modifying with that, well, at least you can partially break them for your own thread because you know you're currently working on that, but the outside world shouldn't notice that this thing is broken since it doesn't know what you're doing locally. So you have a certain interest that updates to several memory locations are hidden from others during the time that you update them. So what you usually would like to have is some way of implementing an automaton, distributed automaton being a protocol that ensures mutual exclusion. So this is a thing that appears quite often in algorithms, so this is a good thing to generalize. So the idea is to find out a concept that enforces mutual exclusion in your software. So more graphically, what we want to have is to go a single step in our execution that interacts with multiple memory locations at the same time without interfering with others. So what could those resources be in practical programs? Well, usually when we talk about these kinds of resources, we talk about memory locations, which can be interesting by themselves either, or you might have something like memory mapped input-output, so that the value that you put into that memory location gets transported to whatever device is connected with that. So memory mapped I/O is also an application for that. File handles can be an example, but also buffers in your network device or whatever you can imagine can map into your local memory. And as already indicated, one thing that is important for that kind of interaction with shared resources is that usually you want at least a minimum amount of invariance being held while you interact with these resources. For example, you might imagine that you want to access a shared linked list that is linked from the end to the beginning, for example, and for this kind of data structure, you would like to have valid pointers from head to tail and vice versa. So this might be an invariant that you want to ensure that happens. And what is especially complex in there is that these invariants might not be just an invariant on just a single value of a memory cell, but they might span multiple resources. So there might be some relational invariants going on that you need to keep, and well, they can be quite complex. The third thing that we have already mentioned is that while you're doing your update, you want to be able to freely work on that without interfering with someone else. So what you typically also do is that while performing these updates, since the only ways that you can do that is piece by piece, you usually break these invariants locally during the time when you do the actual update with the goal of re-establishing these invariants before you leave your update, and then everything looks as if the invariant is still holding when you allow access for anyone else to your shared resources. So all in all, what you need is that multiple resources may be updated together to ensure that particular invariant. So the term that you have already heard about that is this term atomic, and what you would like to have is that the outside world perceives your update as being one single step in that sense. And this is what the definition of atomic execution for the purposes of this particular subtopic should be. The computation forms an atomic execution if its effect can only be observed as a single transformation in memory. So from everyone else except for yourself, everything that is done to that particular resource is observable just as one single step. So there's several ways for atomic updates to be realized, and they differ a little bit in terms of complexity, in terms of need of hardware support, and in terms of, well, what their general properties are. So we will address several of them now in this part, starting from a very close to the machine implementation to more and more abstract implementation. We will use these lower level entities in order to or as building blocks for larger entities. And we stay we try to stay as generic as possible, in the sense that the things that we will present here are available on most platforms in one or the other way, and also appear in most existing concurrent pieces of software that you find out there. And well, they have two sides. Well, for once, they provide solutions to common concurrency tasks, but might introduce problems on the other hand, depending on which particular approach we take and what its properties are. So usually the things that you find here in that part of the lecture are techniques that you can find somewhere in systems like C, C++, Java, and C Sharp, and also a lot of other imperative or imperatively inspired languages. So what we will see here is principle of atomic executions, and we instantiate them as in weight-free algorithms based on these atomic operations. And with those, then, we build up data structures for locks on concurrent systems with several processors, and then come to the problems that arise from them via the topic of deadlocks. So let's dive right into them and start with the weight-free atomic executions. So the introductory things are very, very small-scale instructions that you see here, and you have several programs here that you might wonder which of these things are usually considered to be atomic on the CPU. So, well, let's have a look at program 3, for example, because that is looks like the most complicated ones. So is that typically atomic on a usual CPU? Who is in favor of atomic? Very timid people today. Okay, not so many. What about program 2? Can that be done atomically? No, but program 3 can. Okay, interesting. How about program 1? Is that a thing that happens atomically? Okay, how? What do you usually do?
Increment registers.
Like ink operation or something like that. And now to the solution in that sense. It is a little bit of a tricky question in the sense that you need to clarify what a CPU means and what atomic means in that sense. So if you come from the direction of, well, the introductory courses, you usually consider the assembly instructions to be like basic units, like atomic in that sense. And if you consider that your CPU would have just one core, for example, and nothing else that goes on concurrently in there, then of course this is an uninterruptible thing from the point of view of the compiler and can be considered to be atomic. If we leave this area of very simplistic machine models and go over to models like we have seen it in the past three lectures, we have already learned that there's machines that have multiple CPUs and even multiple cores that interact with each other, and usually the things that you do as your instructions in there are broken up into several parts that work or that compete for the access to shared resources like memory. So let's imagine that a thing like this I here is represented by some memory cell. Then you already have like several instances, several actors in the system with several CPUs that possibly compete for access to that thing. And we have also seen that there's this effects about like pulling a cache line from the main memory into your local cache, then making it exclusive to you by sending around these invalidate messages is a process that needs some time, and usually other processes can work during that time and might also issue their own messages around that. So what you usually have to implement that is you this increment, even though it's an assembly routine, it tries to obtain the cache line. It pulls out the value for I, increases it, and then writes it back to its cache line. And this is already several steps that are going on, which are in that sense not guaranteed to be atomic anymore in the presence of several cores. Yes, please?
Depending on the CPU, there may even be interrupts during the execution of one single operation, even if it's just in registers.
So there are several causes for these instructions to be non-atomic in that sense. Well, the registers, and if those are interruptible or not, well, this may be a little bit depending on whether you can really observe that a particular register is in an inconsistent state. So usually if you can't observe that from somewhere else, then you might debate whether you would really realize that this is interrupted. But if you interrupt that at a place where you have pulled it into your register in order to flip it or to increase it, then of course this is also a cause for delay in that sense. So anyway, yeah?
Isn't after an interrupt everything goes back to normal?
Yeah, but you have time passed on, and you can't really say what happens to your cache during that time. So depending on what these things, how they are implemented, whether they are on memory or on registers, they can have several complications in that. So all in all, for concurrent systems, there's no real guarantee for any of these things to be atomic at all, even without storing it. Validate buffers, just the having caches and competing for cache lines is enough for for these programs not to be atomic anymore. So, the interleaving of loads and stores from other processors is the main reason for that. So, the thing is, you still tend to say, tend to say that these things are atomic, and the intuition always gives you a hint that, well, you would want them to be atomic in particularly the first one, for example. So there is ways to make them atomic, but not by just the simple increment instruction that is there. Instead, what you can do is, for example, on the x86 system, you can make them atomic by setting another flag that as an implementation on x86, for example, does the following. It locks the cache bus for addresses, for particular addresses, and you can lock the cache bus for the address of this variable I, for example, for the duration of one assembly instruction. If that is, for example, this increment operator, then this thing is
means
say
none of the CPUs can access the cache at this memory position?
This means that messages that concern that particular address are suppressed. Like, no other instruction can issue an invalidate message for that thing, can issue a read message. So nothing that concerns that particular address is going through the message bus.
Needs to send an invalidate.
Yes.
It can't send it, right?
It can't send it, exactly.
But it would mean the MESI requires to send it.
It has to wait then.
But then we have two changes, maybe it's still at the same time.
Well, the change shouldn't be able to be done if you don't receive an acknowledgement. So Yeah, you will need to wait during that time. So, well, this locking can be done for all of these examples from up there. So for program 1 to program 3, there is instances of instructions that are marked with this lock flag, on x86 at least, this lock thing that is just added in front of the actual instruction, and this makes the instruction being carried out with no addresses concerning the memory operand of this instruction being allowed during the execution of that thing. So this concern this means for program 1, for example, that I's address is locked, and then if that is the case, then there's no interference on the on this memory cell, there's no invalidate messages reaching the message bus, the cache bus, and thus there's no races on the content of the cache line until the whole thing is finished. Then there's, what else is there? There's the this program 2, which essentially, what does it do is, well, it saves the value of some memory address I into J, which is in that context meant to be a register, for example. So this is J is a register, I is a memory operand, and in the next step, some value K is added to I's value, and that is the effect of that thing. So yeah, this is what this exchange and add operation does, and it usually doesn't do that without interference from other cores if you don't lock that thing. And well, this is how you do that here. Then the last one is an exchange thing that gives you back the, well, doesn't necessarily do so. It's just an exchange between two a memory cell and a register in that sense. So the memory cell goes to the value of the register, and the register obtains the former value of the memory cell. And this is what this exchange instruction does. And yeah, you can lock that too to obtain an uninterruptible instruction. You might wonder whether such minimal algorithms that almost don't deserve this name algorithm are really meaningful, and well, there's an example for that. So there is a concept of very minimalistic memory management, an allocator for heap memory, for example, and this is a kind of a gatekeeper for a common resource, the main memory, and usually as a thread you would like to reserve some space where you can work without interfering with someone else. So usually go to the main allocator and reserve a large chunk of memory and work on that locally until you run out of that, and then allocate a new one. But still there is this common this common resource, which is the management of the free heap memory, that needs to be done centrally. So there's a there's need for organizing this common access, and this is where our wait-free algorithms will shine. So what usually is done in the alloc, well, there's a lot of things done, but for this particular simple alloc thing, what the algorithm looks like is that it has the start of the free memory being set to the first free value, which is kept centrally for the for this allocation management, and then this first free is incremented by the size of whatever memory chunk has been has been queried by some thread, so the size is added to this first free to shift it further on, so that the next thread that allocates new memory will start at a later address. And yeah, then there's some other things that are done that are not really so much of interest. In the end, we return this value start. So, in order for that to work properly, what you will need to do is you will need to have this addition to be kept exclusively for that particular part of the system, just for this allocation, and it needs to be atomic. Also, the old value needs to be given back with the right value in mind. So, raising this addition from several threads is a bad idea. So, what can you do? Well, this is a perfect example for our special purpose implementation, and what it usually does is, well, you can replace this addition and this saving of the old value by our fancy locked exchange and add operation. And well, it's a little bit ugly in there because you need to somehow embed it into your high level code, thus you need some additional parameters that connect the variables that you refer to from your high-level language to certain components of this assembly instruction. But still, essentially, what happens there is that you have a locked xadd, and how the exact details of mapping your variables to these operands of the instruction works, this depends on your concrete compiler and might differ a little bit on your system depending on where you really work on that, but usually you have some kind of interface to your low-level assembly. So this is what the thread-safe implementation looks like, and I'm terribly sorry that this cuts the last line in half. This didn't look like that back at my computer. Anyway, this core functionality is what you can realize with the fetch and add from the slides before. And yeah, in practical systems you might not see such a direct assembly reference as this one, because there is for the main compiler suites there's an alternative library call that exactly does this this fetch and add, and GCC, for example, offers a lot of API methods that realize these wait-free things, but they internally usually resort to one of the offered assembly instructions at least for realizing these kinds of behaviors. So with that you can implement meaningful algorithms. What else is there that usually is able to be, maybe not now, for the purposes of the slides later on, not to be cluttered with a lot of assembly code, what I now do is I introduce the convention that we have here, that we use a made-up keyword atomic together with a block in order to express the semantics that we have seen before. Namely, that the instruction that is inside of the block that belongs to this keyword atomic is intended to be translated in the wait-free version instead of the box standard translation scheme. Be careful, this atomic keyword doesn't exist in this same way on concrete machines, but I want to have my slides clean and not like full of assembly instructions that that fill up every line in there, and it's better to have them that way. However, it's not a real instruction. Please don't use them in actual programs and then complain that there's errors when compiling. So yeah, these atomic blocks are just denoting this atomic execution. Also, you can't write arbitrary stuff in there. It's only things for which there are actual real weight-free implementations available on your system that you can put in there, and everything else just doesn't work. So these things are very limited. Yeah. However, having atomic execution for certain sequences of instructions is quite a general concept. There turn out to be a few other instruction sequences that are usable in this kind of fashion. So usually what they have in common is that there's almost no control flow possible, so there's not a lot of if then else, while, for, or whatever in there, but usually there's it's limited to either sequences of instructions, or occasionally you see your singular if branch in there, as in this program 6, for example, but usually there is no thing like control flow happening during these sections. And yeah, so what are the other ones that you find out there? Well, there's program 4 and 5, for example. They work quite similar in a certain way. So you have memory cell B that serves as a carrier for some kind of flag. And what you do is you first of all read out the old value of the flag into something that is based in a register, and then follow up with storing some Boolean flag into this B. And depending on whether you want to set that to true or false, you can choose program 4 or 5. So these are called set and test instructions. And yeah, you set them to a particular value and can get back the value that they had before in a location that is exclusive to you, in that case, register. And the last category there is this program 6, where you essentially do a conditional update to the memory, and this is called the compare and swap. What you do is you have a particular condition, and if that condition is fulfilled, you manipulate a memory cell to a value that you put in from a register. And what is that condition? The condition is just abbreviated over here, and as a side effect is also put into another register R. So what you can do in that sense is you test the content of a particular memory cell for compliance with a value, in this case also from a register, and if it's if these values are equal, then the value is overwritten with some new value. And in general, you can then do something depending on what the former value of the memory cell in question was. So you get some idea whether your update will have been successful or not. But usually it's guarded by this particular condition. And this is called a compare and swap. So, yeah. These are now very, very small mini algorithms that you can use, and you might wonder whether you can use the particular properties that they have in order to build up something larger than just these very, very limited semantics that are given there. So if you use them as building blocks, what do you then obtain? Well, this is even has a name. This is the topic of block-free algorithms. So let's have a look at how they usually work. So these are algorithms that are applied always then when the when your algorithm just touches a very few data, but does some maybe complicated update on them that doesn't fit into one instruction. And you can still make use of the weight-free instructions by a particular pattern. And what you use for that is usually this compare and swap instruction. But there's also other log-free algorithms that are based on whatever is available on these architectures. So common usage pattern for doing larger updates on particular few memory cells is this one here. This is based on compare and swap. So what you do there is usually you plan to apply some complicated function f to the content of some memory cell I and want to update I with whatever comes out of that. This is the desired behavior, what you want to implement. And this is quite close to what you've seen before. It's an update on one particular cell. However, this f turns out to be larger than just a single addition. It might be something quite complicated, some recursion involved or whatever, arbitrarily difficult. But you still would like to benefit from this very compact way of making sure that you have atomic updates in the system. What can you do then? Well, what you do is you read your initial value of I into something that is exclusive to you, like maybe memory cell, but usually register K. So you do that concurrency save by using memory barriers or whatever, and then compute your algorithm on this locally cached version of I and obtain a new value for that. So you do this computation locally for you. And then what you just do is you update the value of I to J in case that the value that I is currently holding is still the one which you had obtained before you started the whole computation. And this directly matches the compare and swap that we had on a few slides before. So this is exactly the condition that we have seen there, and this comes quite in handy then for that particular behavior. And we might still have a failure in this condition if the value of I has changed in between. Then our compare and swap doesn't perform the actual swap, but instead will indicate that the value of I has changed in between. So in that case, we can then return to the beginning, to the first step, if the value of I hasn't been K, and redo our computation on the now actual value, and then try to push our change into the variable I and repeat that until at some point we have succeeded with performing our update. So there's quite a few applications for that also, and this is kind of an active field of research to replace algorithms that are used in concurrent software in many implementations to replace implementations that are based on actual real locks with semaphores, UTCs, monitors, or whatever, with ones that are based just on these wait-free instructions and the and some lock-free algorithm. So it's a matter of coming up with a new special-purpose lock-free algorithms in order to try to get a lot of locking out of systems, because locking usually leads to performance losses and is not so desired in systems where there's a lot of traffic. Well, the correctness, of course, is still a desired property, but you would like to do that without a lot of congestion in particular locks. So lock-free algorithms are the way to go in that sense. So what are the general properties in which that indicate that you can use or come up with such a lock-free algorithm? Well, you usually have to look what is available to you. So you need to compare and swap operation. I need to clarify for what data type this is specified in your architecture. This limits the size of data on which you can actually perform that kind of stuff, because if you want to then continue with lock-free algorithm, you need to make sure that you can group all the variables for which an invariant must hold into these n bytes that are available for the compare and swap. Otherwise, well, it's just too large and you can't deal with that then anymore. What then is given to you is that these bytes are then read atomically. You now have to think about how to compute a new value for that, and this is a thing that needs to be done in a repeatable way, since you might fail in your first attempt and then redo the computation. So this must be a thing that is independent on some side effects, for example, since they might change from your first try to compute the update, and then will yield something completely different and might not be desirable. So it needs to be a pure function in that sense. And then you usually do a compare and swap on these n bytes. So yeah, we have said computing must be repeatable or pure. So, downside of all that is, well, of course, you are restricted to just a single atomic operation, usually. It varies between the architectures which of the presented programs you actually get in a wait-free implementation. So there's this exchange, compare and swap, fetch and add, and modify and test instructions, but not all of them might be available on your system. On x86, you get a lot of them already out of the box, so you don't have to worry so much about that, but this varies a little bit between the architectures. So yeah, that's that. And what also is in common for those is that usually these instructions only allow one memory operand, all the others need to be in registers. If you consider that they are implemented by locking out certain memory-based messages on the cache bus, then you might imagine why they are actually allowing only for one memory operand. Yeah, so although they are so limited in the properties where you can really use them, you might still use them as building blocks for larger entities, particularly for a group of instructions that we call locks. So let's have a look of how to implement locks with these data structures. So first of all, what are locks? Well, locks are usually data structures that are intended to be acquired and released. So these are the typical actions on locks. Acquire and release are the important ones. The purpose of a lock is that you usually apply them in order to guarantee mutual exclusion, in the sense that only one thread may hold the lock at a time and has to actively release that. So it acquires that, then holds the lock, and then release leads to freeing the lock for someone else. What is also supposed to do is it needs to block other threads' attempts to acquire it while it's held by you. So, yeah, blocking is a thing that we need to implement. Also, what they usually have is, well, while you hold the thread, you want to work on code that is given to you and, in the form of this critical section. This is the piece of code that you want to be atomic. So, well, the warning already appears here. When you have this kind of concept, you might also deadlock the program, and that means that, well, no one can go further in its execution anymore. So, well, that's that. So, let's start with the first of all those. That's the semaphore. So, what is a semaphore usually? Well, in our purposes, what we use that for is a memory cell that contains an integer value. In our purposes, we just call it S, with together with a few operations that are used for realizing this acquire and release. And I don't know how many people have had semaphores or locks in their introduction to computer science. So you've seen implementations of these things already, at least with single core machine model in mind, I guess. So what you always have to keep in mind is that now we're going over to the multi-core view on these things, so there might be a few things changing, particularly the requirements of some instructions needing to be atomic in that sense. So the two usual operations on semaphores now are this wait and signal, with wait being the one that is the candidate for the acquire, and signal is the one that you do when you want to release your lock. So what's done in there? Well, let's start with the acquire. You obtain the address of the semaphore here, so the address of a memory cell with an integer, and well, then you reserve some space for a boolean that you need later on. Then you essentially enter a while loop, and in this while loop you already see that I have placed an atomic block. So this is a thing that makes use of the wait-free instructions that we have introduced a little bit earlier. And what we want to do atomically is this block over here, which is essentially a evaluation of a conditional together with an update that is there, or a decrement in that case. But this is usually what is considered to be realizable in a wait-free algorithm. So you have a singular condition between, well, in this case it's a constant, but might be a register value and a memory value, and then you perform an update on the memory value in case that the condition is done, and you get the result back in a register and can work on that with this available thing. So so in detail, what you do is you evaluate whether the value in your integer is different from zero, and if it's different, then it's usually larger than zero, and if that is the case, then the whole thing is considered to be available, and what we would do then is you would decrement that by one, and if this is not larger than zero, then there is no resources left in the context of a semaphore, so you are not allowed to proceed. So in that sense, what you will then get is that the avail will be false, the block will end, and then the while enters the picture, where we evaluate the while condition, which is, well, if there has not been available resources, we have to loop back to the beginning and redo the whole thing. So for our purposes here, for that simple version of the thing, we have an ever-looping while loop, as long as there this S is constantly zero. As soon as this S has something different in there, then it will be swapping to, well, this line here, which will open up the progress by making the whiles conditional false, and then we will leave this wait thing. So in as soon as that happens, the acquire will terminate, and we will continue with our execution. So on the other side, what happens when you do the signal? This is usually what you do when you do the release of your semaphore variable. Well, what that does is it makes sure that the fact that you leave the your critical section is noticed by the system. And how do you notify? Well, we have to swap the value of S out from zero to something different, or, well, in the general case here, we just have to increase the value of S. So this is what we do, and we would like to do that in an atomic way, and thus apply this SSS plus 1 in the atomic block. So both of them have equivalence in weight-free instructions. So this is what we're going to use for realizing this these atomic blocks here. Acquiring will execute wait. If this resource is available, then wait will return. Otherwise, it will block by, well, looping through the while loop. And once the thread finishes, it's supposed to call signal in order to release. So the special case for semaphore would be to initialize the whole thing with 1. If you do that, then you will only allow 1 one actor to call acquire and actually enter its critical section. And if that is just 1, then this is kind of mutual exclusive access to the area between the acquire and the release. And with that, you get then a special case of the semaphore, which we call the mutex. So initializing this semaphore with 1 gives us a binary semaphore in that sense. You can use that to block and unblock threads and protect resources. Of course, this is just a very simple implementation. You might be interested in systems that don't do actual looping on the check for whether the semaphore is available or not, but you might want to do something more intelligent. And what you can do there is you can go to the operating system and deschedule your thread, so you go to sleep in that sense, and you don't do that randomly with just some longer period of time, but in modern systems you usually can hand over an address of a memory cell that you are actually interested in. So with that you give the system a particular reason when to wake you up again, particularly whenever something has changed on that particular memory address, you would like to be woken up. And since this might not be the desired change, you still need to go through the whole evaluation of the condition again, but in principle you give the operating system a chance to only wake you up in case there has been a change happening. So this is a thing that is given to you, well, not magically, but this is given to you by the operating system, and this encodes it in, well, particular ways. On Linux systems, for example, there is a kernel implementation of NewTCs that is called this Futex implementation, and there's a certain way of communicating with this data structure that you actually want to wait for a particular address changes, and if there's a change registered for that, then your thing is awakened again. It's relatively difficult to find out how they really do that internally, but I think there is ways of kind of trapping accesses to certain memory cells and then get a callback to that whenever there is an access to that thing happening. So if you register that, then you might be already successful with this kind of needs for waking up and going to sleep. Well, of course, there also needs to be the other side of the coin that does the actual waking up, and this would be depending on whether the system does automatically register that you do some changes on memory addresses with this assignment, for example, then this is already sufficient. If your system needs to actively communicate that you want to wake up someone specific, then you might add such a wake S that then is the same, referring to the same S as the deschedule over here, and then you have a connection through the actual value of the address that you give that thing. So yeah, either way, depending on what your operating system is capable of or what the system general offers you as functionality, this is a thing that you can use for that particular situation. So this is like the more sophisticated version. The real world is even more complicated. If you have a look into the your system's kernel, in case you can do so, some systems allow that, then you might be interested in what they actually really do. And it turns out that this is not so particularly easy to decipher. There is code in there that actually does these wait-free updates, but it's hidden deeply in these systems, and there's a lot of other aspects that deal with these semaphore implementations that might confuse you a lot. There's, for example, heuristics in place that that say that you don't want to have pure busily waiting systems, and you also don't want systems that do immediately deschedule. Since descheduling is a thing that is a process of, well, a lot of instructions that need to deal with registering you into some queue and changing out cache contents and all that. So this is a thing that you usually don't want to do too readily when just the semaphore, for example, is only guarding a very short critical section, then you maybe would fare better by just doing active busy waiting and don't have to deschedule. So actual systems have heuristics how long it is actually viable to do busy waiting and then go over into actual going to sleep and not deschedule, and it's quite complicated to look at these things, but yeah, there is a lot of heuristics in place that deal with that. So You might wonder what happens in systems where you don't have to think about concurrent accesses from other cores. Well, in that sense, Semaphore usually just reduces to this very easy pattern with an if branch that keeps book of how many resources are still available, and then critical section, and then add that again. So there is no need for any atomic instructions in there. So, common use for semaphores then is what we have seen: mutex. What you might use that for would be, for example, this idea with a double-ended Q data structure. I think it's a doubly linked Q data structure. What was meant there, but this seems a little bit odd. Well, nothing to worry right now, I would say. But in principle, if you have complicated data structures that need some invariants to be kept, then you might want to protect them with mutexes to ensure mutual exclusion. So, in order to not keep too much concurrency out of your system, but allow for actual speed up through concurrency, you might want to decide what elements of your data structures and algorithm actually really need protection and what not. And there might be also complex interactions between some areas being locked with semaphore A, others with semaphore B, and they might also lock them in an interleaved way in order to allow for particular areas to be concurrent while others not. So can be quite liberal in your use of locks in that sense. So and the next concept we want to look at is monitors. What is the motivation for that? Well, a common usage pattern for mutexes is usually that you acquire your lock when you enter a function that deals with a particular data structure, and you want to release the lock upon exit from this function. So this is a reoccurring pattern, so you might wonder whether you would like to generalize that. However, you buy yourself into a few problems if you do that with just plain locks. For example, if there's recursive calls or calls from one operation that works with a data structure to another operation that works with a data structure, you get twice tries to acquire the same lock, which will usually end in blocking. And this is a thing that you would usually want to circumvent in usual algorithms. Also, there's still the problem of, busy waiting that might happen. Why is that? Well, imagine, for example, a thread that waits for some data structure, some queue to be filled by some producers in a producer-consumer environment, for example. And accesses its pop instruction to retrieve its data, and if the queue is still empty, for example, it would obtain a -1 to signify that there's no data obtained. Well, the only thing that T can then do is that it has to call again, which then acquires a lock, runs three internal data structures, realizes that this is empty, it has to release lock, and then do that whole again, which is essentially a busy waiting approach. And this is a thing that you might also put some work into to circumvent. So this is where this concept of a monitor comes into the game. So this is a mechanism to address all the problems that we have talked about. And what does it do? Well, if you use a monitor, you usually have some way of associating a few procedures with this particular monitor, and this then makes for automatic acquiring and release of the lock whenever this particular procedure is called or exited. And what you usually want also is that if the lock is already taken by the current thread, then you already are inside of a transaction, and well, why shouldn't you then still continue with doing manipulations on this data structure if you're already aware of what you're doing? And well, in that case, you would just want to pass this locking instruction without blocking, but do the stuff that it does, and then terminate that and yourself, and then be done with that. And this is a thing that we have to manipulate our ways of accessing the semaphores in order to support that. So that is what we are going to do right now with our basic monitor implementation. So the monitor is considered to be now a semaphore count as its base data structure, and in order to be able to distinguish threads from each other, what you usually would like to have is some way of storing an associated thread. For that, you would just manage with another integer that stores the thread ID of the occupying thread. So you now have a composed data structure that has its thread ID and its count value inside as elements. And these are usually initialized with just zero. So monitor init will just put them to zero. Then instead of using wait and signal, you would now provide methods monitor enter and monitor leave that deal with this kind of data structure. And yeah, what it should do is it should ensure mutual exclusion of accesses to this monitor data structure, at least mutual exclusion with respect to the thread ID that is working on that. And yeah, for that, we would usually want to track how many times we have called a particular monitored procedure. And yeah, so counting is a thing that a semaphore is usually quite capable of. So we can try to make use of that in this. So let's have a look at how that all works together. So we have set that monitor enter is the thing that is used to acquire the monitor. So we get the address of the monitor as a parameter. And what we then do is, well, we have a look at the thread ID that is stored right now in the monitor's data structure. And in case that this directly corresponds to the thread ID of the current thread that is obtained with this thread ID thingy, then this will form our property mine. So this usually is true in the case that my thread ID corresponds to the thread ID stored in the monitor. If that is the case, then my thread is considered to be the one that is associated with that thing, so no one else should be able to manipulate this thread ID, and I can manipulate that without any worries of interfering with someone else. So what I then am able to do is I can just increment the semaphore's counting part by this. You will register that you have acquired this monitor once more, and if that happens, you can then just continue. Otherwise, there's this else, and this deals with whenever this thing has not been yours already. Well, if this has been yours, then the whole thing will terminate, and you can just start working on your critical section. What happens if you have realized that you are not the owner of the semaphore yet? Well, there's two cases. Either the semaphore is still available, so there is no one registered in there. So in that case, the thread ID of the monitor should be zero. Or there is someone already registered for that thing. In that case, we would have to wait for access to the data structure. So let's have a look at how we realize that. Well, we realize that that inside of an atomic block, since we might compete with others for access to that thing. So the thing that we want to we are competing with others is actually the value of this thread ID thing. This determines whether we are in possession of this monitor or not. So what we will do is we will test whether this thread ID field is zero, and in case that it is actually zero, then we will rewrite it to a new value. And well, due to reasons of space on the slides and also quite repetitive patterns in there, I have now pushed a little bit more into the atomic brackets than would ordinarily be possible to put in there. And these are these two instructions here. They usually don't fit into just one singular atomic instructions on our implementations. Usually I would have to do them outside of the atomic block and introduce their execution with another check for whether we are now owners of the monitor or not. But due to space reasons, I pushed them inside. But just that, so that you are aware of that, those don't need to be atomic in that sense. I just put them there for convenience. And also the other thing is, of course, I won't call a thread ID method within an atomic block. That is a thing that also doesn't work. Usually I would pull this thing out, since thread ID is considered to be always the same value during the same thread, and I can just obtain the thread ID somewhere outside. Since I need it over here also, I should really do that. But for space reasons, I just do that. Don't do that on the slides. Okay, so if you consider that, then everything just boils down into compare and swap instruction. And if you realize it that way, then you can determine whether you got possession of the monitor or not. And in case you have gotten possession of that, you can just set the flag appropriately and initialize the counter with the right number, meaning you have acquired the monitor for the first time, so you set it to 1. In case you haven't gotten possession of that, you will then usually first consider to go to sleep with a deschedule, and particularly since you haven't modified the mind flag, you will just re-enter the whole process again when you have woken up and again compete for possession of this of the monitor's thread ID field. So this is what monitor enter does, and monitor leave is the counterpart that is issued whenever you leave the critical section. So you drop this particular monitor. So what you do there is, first of all, in any case, what you do is you decrement count. And if count has reached 0, you were the last one who had possession of that particular monitor, and in that case what you need to do is you need to do an atomic update on the thread ID, and then you can just wake whoever is waiting for that particular memory area and be done with that. So these are the two new facilities for entering monitors instead of semaphores. And well, with that, what you get is this behavior of being able to re-enter your lock in case that you come with the same thread ID. But what still remains there is this use case that we have sketched a little bit earlier that was there for, well, to illustrate that there is this potential for busy waiting. So there's a use case here with the thread busily trying to pull content from some shared resources, and thus contenting the lock and busily waiting on the whole data structure. And the concept for monitors also includes an idea for dealing with these cases by adding things that are called condition variables. So a monitor data structure usually not only has the thread ID and the counter for how many times you have acquired that particular lock, but it also features a particular number of condition variables that can be accessed from within that monitor. And what are these the functions for that? Well, you can use these, or you're supposed to use these conditional variables with wait and signal from before. So these are accessed in a similar way as the semaphores had been. And you would associate each of these condition variables with a particular semantically determined condition that you want in your program. So in case that you need to wait for a particular event to happen, you associate a condition variable with this event, and you instantiate the thing with semantics that this condition becomes true in case that this event that you have reserved for that is now occurring. So what else are properties of these condition variables? They are supposed to be called while you are in possession of the monitor, so within a monitor enter and leave instruction. And what it will do as soon as you call this wait is not just a simple wait that you know from the semaphores, but it will also temporarily release the monitor for others to enter the monitor and actually trigger the event that is associated with the condition variable. And while this monitor is released, the whole structure blocks. And then there is the case when the event actually is triggered, then the signal is supposed to be called, and then what happens is you usually reacquire all the monitor and return, and then you can continue with whatever reaction you have for this condition to become true. Signal is the other side of the thing that is that you use for messaging waiting threads that the condition that is associated with the condition variable is now fulfilled and that they can proceed. And depending on the semantics of your particular system, either one or all the waiting threads are now woken up, or even some crude semantics where at least one thread is woken up. It depends on what your system guarantees you. And well, there are several possibilities of how this then can happen. So there's a semantics of signal and urgent wait, which means that the signaling thread suspends and continues only after the signaled thread has released the monitor. So in that sense, if you signal, you know that you will go to sleep immediately. And then there's the concept of signal and continue, where you don't go to sleep directly, but instead continue with your work. And once you once you release the monitor, either because you terminate your critical section or you do another wait on a conditional variable or so, then the signal threads will have a chance to enter and continue work. So there's a few graphics that do with that. So for the signal and urgent wait semantics, there's the idea that you have an enter that possibly blocks. So this is like this antechamber that you have here, where everyone needs to wait to be entering this central room, where there's only one actor all the time. And you, this main room has as many other chambers as there are conditional variables. So for each of them, there is a different waiting room where you can send all your threads that wait on a conditional variable, this wait instructions in two, and there you can gather several people in there, each waiting for a particular condition to happen. And whenever the main actor that is in the main room does a signal, this is maybe not the one to mark. Whenever it does a signal, then it will have to go into, where is it? Where is it? Here. When you do a signal, then you this will then enter another waiting room. This is for the urgent wait purpose. So there is everyone who has done a signal. He has to go in there, and immediately the one that has been signaled will be able to leave his waiting room and enter the main room, and so on. So this is the kind of graphical model for this signal and urgent wait. Yeah, and apart from that, yeah, well, there's some details like that the queue of urgent waiters has priority over the queue of the ones that enter the whole thing anew, but, well, it's details. For the signal and continue semantics, there's similar ideas. There is the antechamber here with everyone who is potentially able to enter the main room here. So with an enter, you enter this antechamber, and you queue up for entry into the main thing, where there's only one actor in there all the time. And in case that you are interested in a certain condition to be fulfilled, you usually call wait and then enter the respective queues for the condition B or A, whatever is there. And yeah, what happens when the main actor does a notify is that the main actor remains in the room while with a notify, depending on the conditional variable on which you have done a notify, the respective actor in there will be transferred from the waiting queue into the antechamber and compete for entry into the main chamber. And only when the main actor deliberately decides to release possession of the of the monitor by some kind of leave instruction, then someone from the antechamber will be admitted to the main room. So this is what the signal and continuous semantics is all about. And in this setting, the signal function is usually baptized notify. So the people that have done a little bit of concurrent programming with Java have usually heard about these wait and notify terms already. So this is an indicator that in the Java world you will probably have something similar to this signal and continuous semantics. And turns out that this is actually the case. And what you also get in Java is that you get signal and continuous semantics for only a single condition variable. So in this context, only one condition variable exists for each monitor on which you can then wait or notify them. Yeah. For the condition variables wait and notify, the implementations are now given here. And yeah, see, for the notify, this is not particularly different from what the ordinary signal has been. So this is just incrementing the underlying semaphore again. So this is nothing too special. The only thing that is special for the condition variables in that sense is that we have to temporarily let go of the monitor itself. So this is what is usually done over here. So thread ID is set to zero, and we wait for something to happen on the condition variable. And as soon as something is happening with this, this wait will terminate, and we will have to recompete for possession of the monitor with everyone else from the enter queue. And this is what is done in this do while thing. Due to our time reasons, I won't go too much detail into that thing, but usually what is there is that you compete for this thread ID field of the monitor once again, but just set it to your old thread ID and count value instead of establishing a new one. So it's kind of retaking the monitor with the old context that you had. So yeah, a thing that also as one of the Java programmers, you usually should have had contact with that. There's this disambiguation between notify and notify all. So it's different semantics. One only awakes, well, it says exactly here. Usually this is not like exactly, but at least one thread, but not guaranteed more than one thread is awoken there. And notify all will just waken up everyone that wakes on that waits on the condition variable. So, yeah, this is kind of a thing that is an optimization, optimization. You get weaker guarantees if in practical systems in notify, if you just promise to notify some of the waiting threads, not just particularly one. So the programmer of such system should assume that the thread is not the only one that's woken up. So this is a little bit the change picture when you have just one particular condition variable. This is what you see in C or C sharp. And the monitor is not directly programmed, but is working or is actually really just used by the compiler in case that you mark something with synchronized. And what this then automatically will do is it will add this monitor enter and monitor leave instructions in the code that is generated from that. Of course, there's also these synchronized blocks, but they also just automatically add this monitor enter and monitor leave in whatever they generate. And yeah, the object itself then contains everything that is needed for managing the monitor, like the count, the condition variables, and the actual thread ID. So this is all kept in the surrounding object class. So the thing that we still need to talk about is deadlocks, but I think this needs more than just 2 minutes, so I think this is a good spot to stop right now. So I hope you found that amusing, and we'll see us next week. Thank you.